No. Then he orders a magnitude beyond what I can resolve. I say, what in the world is going on? Physically, they looked identical. I could measure all the elements with my ruler and the space in between the elements. Identical. And I said, what in the world is the difference of these antennas? The Vizwire was a little bit different between them, but the gain had huge differences by my standards. Then got the next idea. I took my ohm meter, put one lead of the ohm meter on the boom, and with the other lead of the ohm meter, I went and touched each one of the elements that went through the boom. About one quarter of those elements made no contact to the boom. The elements went through the boom. There was a saddle structure to the left and the right side of the boom where the element came out with a screw in it, tugging on that element, making sure that it was bound to that boom. That whole structure built up enough aluminum oxide in a couple of years that the elements were breaking contact with the boom entirely. The boom grabs onto the element on the left side and the right side, this half-inch diameter boom, so that each element, half-inch away from center, was being grabbed by the boom, which was supposed to be making contact. And as the elements broke contact with the boom, their equivalent electrical length was changing by almost a half-inch. The antenna was retuning itself to some of the frequency.
Repeater, timeout.
So what we're talking about here is that just the way the elements go through the boom and make contact with the boom, that aluminum oxide that's built up there changes the tuning of that antenna by a very measurable amount. And now you want to take individual elements at 440, that was a 432 antenna, and you want to telescope them together and hoping that you're making good contact to the nearest couple of milliohms. I don't recommend that. I won't say it's going to crash and burn and catch on fire, but if you're a real serious guy and you want the antenna to work well for a lot of time in the future, remount those elements. And by the way, if the elements are going through the boom right now without being insulated from the boom, in the case of a five-element Yagi, I think you can get away with it. By the time you get to 8 or 10 elements, the tuning becomes sensitive enough that as they break contact with the boom, depending on the diameter of the boom, they start tuning themselves to some other frequency. You see where I'm going on this one there. Do you happen to know if those elements are already going through the boom? And that's the whole reason why the so-called RIW-19 Yagi has all the elements insulated from the boom with shoulder bushings, black Delrin shoulder bushings. Now, if I tune them in that manner, they ain't going to change because they break contact with the boom, because they never had any contact with the boom. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the TechNet.
According to the photograph, now this is, he has 5 directive elements, so this Yagi has to have quite a few elements. I don't know how many, but the photograph looks like they are aluminum welded right to the boom. Next question is, if he has to replace them, the only material he has, which is the exact same diameter, is solid aluminum. That make a difference, because he can press those through after grinding those welds, and he probably have it reground, but he wants to know if solid rods actually are going to give him any difference between that and the hollow ones that exist now. Back to you, Dick.
No difference. Because of the skin effect, the RF energy only sees the outside of each element to the nearest 10,000th of an inch. The RF energy sees only outside of the element, and the RF energy penetrates into that surface of that element less than a 10,000th of an inch. As long as you can make it strong enough, you can make the elements out of a very skinny material, a very thin walled material, that is a couple of thousandths of an inch thick, and it would act like it's solid. You would never know the difference. So you do have to worry a little bit about the way the end of the element is rounded off. The way you chamfer the end of the element of 432 Yagi does make some difference in the tuning of the element. And now my strongest recommendation is that he drill out the elements that are broken. And by the way, to take elements that are usually that large in diameter when they're welded to a boom, pretty good diameter elements, they're probably 3/16 of an inch or 1/4 of an inch diameter.
Like they're 3/8.
Wow. That is a really solid built deck. How in the world do you break three elements in a case like that? You got to hit that with a hammer, or you got to drop it from a 100-foot tower. What's your guess as to how those elements got broken, John?
Well, as I had mentioned, Dick, he got hit with a tree branch, evidently substantial. But what's amazing is, welded to the boom must be some structure, because it didn't even bend, and it broke those elements. They're hollow, but 3/8 elements, they're rigid.
Yeah, almost any method of telescoping those elements onto the studs is going to give you trouble. It's just a matter of time before the aluminum oxide builds up. No matter what you put there to stop it from happening, you're sensitive to milliohms of resistance in that very critical area at the center of a director. His two choices are to go out and buy another Yagi, or drill out the stubs that are there, remount the new elements of the same diameter, the same length, and get them re-welded back the same way. Other than that, he doesn't have guaranteed performance. I didn't say it's going to crash and burn and not work, but if a couple of dB of change in gain would bother you, then don't do what he's recommending. If you only want the antenna to work to the nearest couple of dB, if you can tolerate 2 dB of decrease in gain, then don't worry and go and do it. But if you want that last 2 dB of performance out of the antenna, you've got to obey all the rules. You need nearly ohms of conductivity in the center of each and every director. Over to you, John, K2LIW. I know it sounds crazy. Been there, done that.
Just AC2WGB. Very good, Dick. Well, evidently he is interested in getting the maximum gain out of the antenna, so I think that's a good suggestion. Reinsert the ones that are broken, have them heli arced or reverse welded on there, and he'll be back in business. Okay, I think it's time to go to Paul. We only got a few minutes left, and let's hear what's happening in space. Where are my pictures of Pluto, Paul? Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, hold on, John. There was a guy who made 3 attempts to get in. He wants to make a comment, but I'm only hearing a fraction of a syllable of a word each time he tries. He's getting a whole lot of dropout of the repeater tonight.
Yeah, I heard the same thing, Dick.
Whoever that is, when you give it another try right now, give us your call letters a couple of times in a row. K2LIW.
Okay, it's K2J. I had a quick question concerning what difference would the spacing make director elements if you were using a fiberglass boom as opposed to an aluminum boom?
Yeah, good question, Roger. You cannot make that change. Logically, if you go from an aluminum boom with the welded element into that aluminum boom, where the boom makes a definite change of the equivalent electrical length of that element. The element is 3/8 of an inch long. All of a sudden it hits a boom that's maybe 3/4 of an inch in diameter. The element thinks it's got a brand new diameter in that area. And you readjust the length of the element accordingly. What a Yagi is, it's a number of resonators that you and I call directors that are all tuned to a particular frequency at their length, and they're in a particular location along the boom. You make a bunch of resonators of the right center frequency and the right position along the boom, and you've got a Yagi. Make a change where you, let me drop, you take the aluminum boom and you substitute it with fiberglass, you have entirely different lengths of every one of those elements. You haven't changed the spacing yet. And by the way, when you're tuning a Yagi, the length of every element is extremely critical. You change to the nearest 16th of an inch, and you're getting a measurable change, particularly if it's an accumulative change. If you make one element a little bit longer by a 16th of an inch, another element a little bit shorter by a 16th of an inch, you'll survive. Make them all a 16th of an inch shorter, you've got a Yagi, but it's now tuned to 440 instead of 432, so to speak. When it comes to changing the position of the elements, that's not so sensitive, as long as, again, it's not an accumulative error. You've got somebody's real good design, and he's told you where to mount all of the elements, and you've got a couple of them a half inch too far forward and a half inch too far back. You'll survive. Do it in an accumulative manner, you've got a brand new Yagi. So element spacing is not very sensitive, element length is very sensitive, the element length being so damn sensitive that if you change the diameter of the element, or if you change the chamfering of the tip of the element, you've got a brand new length. You've got to be careful with that. So, fiberglass versus aluminum, you can't make that substitution. You can, but it's a brand new design, and you're going to have to go through a brand new tuning procedure. H-U-J-A-S, K-2-L-I-W, over to you, Roger.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. You've answered my question 100%. Let's get the space report. Thank you so much, Nick. Go ahead, K-2-J-A-S.
We got a happy customer there, John. Okay. Paul, WS2N, tell me what Voyager is doing, among other things. 12 billion miles away, 6 watts of transmitting. That's a QRP transmitter. 12 billion miles away, 17 hours one way, or is it 17, 18 hours one way at the speed of light for the signal to get to you. And that thing, since 1977, is still talking to us. Boy, that's DX. Boy, that's QRP. WS2N, K2RW, you got a call.
This is WS2N. We haven't talked about Voyage in a while, that's right. Voyage 1, last time I looked, was almost up to 133 AU. So I know it's, by next week, I think it'll be there. And Voyage 2 is a little further behind, 108. Maybe 109, probably 109. I think that turned over last week. And the time was, you think of it as one way. I think we're up to 35, probably 36. I think 36 hours, a little over 36 hours round trip. And so we'll be talking about New Horizon, and we'll see how that one's doing. You know, as time goes on, how many AU that's out, you know. I mean, well, it's already 40 AU, you know, but that'll be the new one. Because the average for Pluto is, what, 39? So probably at around 37, 30. Yeah, let's see. Pluto's 39, it's probably around that. I'll have to check on New Horizon. But Pluto's very elliptical. So the space report, let me go on. This is WS2N. There's new fuels that are being developed by NASA, and there's a flight that's going to go up, a test flight next year in 2016, and based on green propellants for, they want to do away with hydrazine. Hydrazine is being used, well, it's actually used since World War II when the Nazis got involved with it, but it's very expensive. Because it's hard to handle, it's corrosive, it's toxic, it's carcinogenic, and NASA's got two fuels that they've been testing, and they're going to send it up on a test vehicle early next year. It's called the Green Propellant Infusion Mission. Send it up, run the thrusters. These are for all the small thrusters on board the spacecraft. You know, maybe 22 Newton. Rockets or even smaller. So I'd like to see that done because the cost of the propellant is high because of all the equipment that's involved that they have to, any kind of preparation of fueling, it's a big deal. And even when the shuttle came back, you used to see everybody running around with, they look like spacesuits on the outside trying to clear the fumes off the shuttle. Well, you wouldn't have to do that with these two new fuels. So I'd like to see that. And it's also going to be less expensive. So propulsion is about the same. So they can't go wrong. In fact, I think one article I read, the thrust might be a little bit more per density of the of that fuel. Mark Kelly, astronaut, he's been in space now, just passed over the 6-month mark, him and Korniego, his counterpart from Russia. So they'll be back in March of 2016 for their 1-year mission. And NASA and Roscosmos, the Russian version of NASA, is thinking about another 1-year mission. They might try that again. One or two more times. So That's always good. They always get prepared for possible Mars missions. One of the guys that just came back on that last flight, he's had over, almost 500 days, or not longer, total time in space, you know, for that Russian. So, I mean, it's actually the equivalent of what it would take if you went to Mars and back. They're getting there. Let me drop it. WS2N. Okay, last week, Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com, he has a company called Blue Origin. We talked about him on the net before. He was out at the Cape down in Florida with NASA officials, government officials, and made an announcement that he's going to be taking over Launch Complex 36. So also going to be building a building down in one of the industrial parks there that he's going to start manufacturing rockets, spacecraft there. So that's another one. I mean, he's developed a spacecraft called the New Shepard. Successfully flew that out in the New Mexico desert in April, and there was nobody on board, suborbital, but eventually he plans on putting people on board that spacecraft called the New Shepard. And he does that, they'll be paid tourists go up suborbital, come back down. But this one in Florida that he's making an announcement for, they don't have an official name yet, he's just calling it the Very Big Brother, will be his orbital version. Blue Origin is a very secretive company and for many years now, and they always knew that he had plans on building an orbital spacecraft, and now that's come out. I mean, it's going to be sometime maybe by the end of this decade where he might get his first flight off. I think that's the earliest, but somebody else that could be doing it. Launch Complex 36, which is
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
But it hasn't been active since 2004 or 5, I think they said was the last flight. But he'll put this one active. 36A, this is 36B. It's going to be used for somebody else. You've got SpaceX. They've taken over Launch Complex 39A. Right now they also have Launch Complex number 40. They've been launching all their rockets from Florida from there. So, with them and 36B. 36B is going to be run by Moon Express, another company. It's really becoming a commercial space race down there. And, you know, across the whole United States. Got all kinds of production facilities and test facilities in Mexico, and got a spaceport being built, a private spaceport being built in Mexico. A lot of things going on, but you know, we're going to have to wait a couple of years. Anxious to see who the first paying tourists and which company succeeds at doing it first. Virgin Galactic has had their problems with last year's accident, which killed one pilot. The other guy survived. They're having a hard time recovering from that, although they are getting involved in another type of launching spacecraft. They plan on launching unmanned spacecraft, payloads up to 500 pounds. They'd like to develop that system. Unrelated from the manned spacecraft that they've developed. A couple other things. I don't think we have Craig on frequency for the, you know, for the astronomy net, but I read that next week, next Sunday night, actually at this time, we should have an eclipse, a full lunar eclipse, and the maximum time would be 10:47. So. You know, during the net, if you have a clear night, according to what I read, public got the right data, because I just read this recently. Maybe if Craig's on, he'll let me know. If not, you can always get it to his astronomy net, which is on Tuesday night at 8:30. Fortunately, it's not every week. And another, sticking with that topic, Enceladus, a moon of Saturn, is being talked about as having a global ocean underneath the ice. That moon has been photographed many times by the Cassini spacecraft that's been in orbit around that planet since 2004. But, they're always interested in these places that, and there are quite a few now, that have come up with water, evidence of water. We'll be looking at that. I always like to talk about at least one Hingham thing that's going up. This was on the news line. There's a flight going up very shortly. I believe October 8th, called Fox 1A CubeSat. Well, what I'm going to have, it's supposed to be so good that you should be able to use an HT, a dual band HT, to work it. And uplink frequency will be 435.180, and downlink is 145.980. And it's called Fox 1A. All right, Dick, there's plenty more, but I think that's plenty to talk about. There's all kinds of developments going on out in California, and they're working on SETI antennas, and as soon as they're going to have that ready in a couple of years, they'll have another one called the...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And they're going to be looking for little green men. A lot going on, Dick. We'll turn it back to you for any questions, comments. If anybody wants to reach me, it's spacenetreport@gmail.com, or my call at ws2n@arrl.net. Back to you, Dick. WS coming.
That's a nice easy one to remember. ws2n@arrl.net. The SETI Society, not SETI League, SETI Incorporated. Anyhow, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, this group in California, and there's two separate groups out there. One is by Paul Shuck, I think that's the one that's called SETI League, and then there's this larger organization that came earlier. I think you're saying they've got a new antenna to do SETI search. I know that they're coming up with better and better computer processing techniques that can look at more frequencies at once with more sensitivity. But tell me about this new antenna, Paul. WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, the one I'm talking about is by Paul Allen. He's got, I don't know, a couple of dozen of these antennas out in California somewhere. I don't think he's complete. He's got a lot more to do. But, that's going to be minuscule compared to this thing that they want to build out in South Africa, and they're going to combine it with Australia, 3,000 antennas. I have the dimension. I forgot how many, 3 meters or something. 10-foot antennas, 3,000 of these things spread across two continents, and then, using it for interferometry, connecting them. And they plan on being 50 times more sensitive than, I guess, the Paul Allen group up in California. I got all their numbers right before they build this. Forgot how many millions of dollars it's going to cost. They're working on it, and at one time they're going to have just one, either Australia or Africa, and now they've decided to have both and then link them together for a real sensitive antenna setup. Back to you, Dick.
When you set up a interferometer, you do gain some extra area. In other words, if I've got an acre of area in the United States, an acre of area in Australia, and I set them up just right. I've got 2 acres of area, therefore I've got twice as much effective capture area, and I've got 3 feet more antenna gain. The main reason you do a long range interferometry between nations is to get higher directivity. You would like to have the angular resolution of an antenna that's as big as spreading from the United States to Australia, for instance. So rarely do they do long-range interferometry for extra sensitivity. You do pick up some extra sensitivity, but you pick up directivity by orders of magnitude. You got many miles, thousands of miles of separation between the two. All of a sudden, you get angular resolution down to milliseconds of arc, microseconds of arc, so to speak. So that allows you to see the fine details of a nebula or galaxy or star, things like this. But to do a SETI search, the angular resolution is not the main thing that limits SETI search. It's being on the right frequency with enough sensitivity, enough effective capture area. That's what really gives you sensitivity in a SETI search, I think. Let me drop. So it's a good thing to do, but I guess they didn't yet make it clear from what you've read so far, Paul. Are they doing it for angular resolution or extra area? If they're doing it for extra area, it's a lot easier to just buy the adjacent piece of property and fill it up with antennas to your current antenna farm. Now, one other thing I wanted to mention is that Matt Damon, a very good actor, has made some very nice movies. Bourne set of movies, The Bourne Identity. And also, he's the creator of the movie The Good Will Hunting. Good Will Hunting. Which also had, can't think of his name right now, a good comedian that recently committed suicide. But a very well-made movie. He's come out with a movie that's going to be released on October 2nd, I think it is, called The Martian. And as I understand the story, let me drop. By some means, his group of people that visited Mars had to leave in a hurry, and he got left behind. So he's got to survive on Mars for a couple of years until they can come back and rescue him. And you see him in his spacesuit, and he's now wandering around Mars. He's got to set up a farm where he can grow food. He's got to find the sources of oxygen and water in order to survive. And obviously, I know Matt Damon, he's a real crafty guy. In his movie, he's going to survive. But in reality, if you had to farm to make enough food on Mars, which has got 0.02 ounce of oxygen we've got on the Earth, at ridiculously cold temperatures, nowhere near as much sunlight, high winds and dust storms, and in that environment you're going to farm food, and he's running around with this very exotic looking space suit, but Mars is essentially a high vacuum by our standards. And so when I look at that space suit, let me drop it. You got to suspend an awful lot of good science in order to buy into the story. You take a look at a real spacesuit of an Apollo astronaut walking around on the moon, and that spacesuit has to create all the air pressure you and I would have on Earth. So the thing is highly inflated, blowing up like a balloon. You got great difficulty bending the joints because the volume of the spacesuit changes when you bend an elbow, and that suit is going to fight you. It doesn't want you to bend that elbow because you're compressing a portion of this inflated suit. And to take a look at the suit that you see trailer for the movie The Martian with Matt Damon, and I don't see anything like that as a suit. It's not a believable suit. Couldn't walk around on Mars with that. So, I think it's going to be a nice movie, but it's not going to be a highly accurate movie. It's not going to represent the real world of what Mars is like, what the suit is like. But maybe the rest of the story will be good. I did a quick calculation. You said 133 astronomical units, apparently where Voyager is today, and that calculates to be 12.37 billion miles. Astronomical unit is basic distance between Earth and Sun, which is around 93 million miles. take 93 million, multiply it by 133 astronomical units, you come up with a 12.37 billion miles. That's DX. That's down the road a piece. And it's moving away from us at some ridiculous speed, like something like 35,000 miles an hour. It's a guess on my part, Paul.
Repeater, timeout.
That Voyager, each of those Voyager spacecrafts are moving away from us at a very high speed. I think it's like 35,000, isn't that true? WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, 38,000 miles per hour. And, yeah, okay, on Voyager. The, I just want to mention the, before I forget, it's called a square kilometer array. And there are three, like I said, 3,000 antennas are going to be involved, and each one 15 meters in diameter, so, you know, 40, 50 feet in diameter, each one. So it's a lot of different people putting the money in. I guess there's some people interested in this. I don't think it's government money, but maybe it is, maybe some of it is. And the Martian, I read the book a couple of years ago, Dick. And the second I read it, I said, this thing is going to become a movie. Nothing will. Fantastic book. And accuracy, like you said, the high winds, you know, that's what causes everything. The problem why he winds up staying on Mars, you know, the storm that comes through. But there's no storm on Mars that could do what's going to happen in this movie. So, but they have to do something. And nevertheless, the crew leaves them behind. So the spacesuit you see him in is not his spacesuit. His gets ruined during the storm, and he uses one of the other people. Their spacesuits were left behind. They left in a real hurry, according to the flight plan. If something like this happens, they're out of there. So I'm not going to tell you that. I mean, I'm not going to tell you anything about the movie, because that's not a good idea. But,
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Tell yourself before, you can see on the trailer that they have. And you're right, October 2nd, that's coming out. And Damien, yeah, he had a part in Interstellar. He played one of the astronauts. But we'll see how he does here. And potatoes, that's what they... grows millions of potatoes. Well, this, see, you know, everybody had a job when they went up to Mars on that flight. And his was, his main job was not only mechanic, but botanist. So he was into that. So he knows really good how to grow all these potatoes and last for some 490 days. But there's a lot to it. He's got to travel across the surface deck. He's got to use rovers. And, you'll have to see the movie. And the book, if there's anything like the book, it should be very good. Back to you, K2RIWWS.
Dick, that was Robert Williams you were trying to think of before.
Well done. He was the psychiatrist in the movie Good Will Hunting. And that was a rather well-made movie. Kind of fun to watch that one. Damon played a good part. So did Robert Williams. Robert Williams has been in a number of movies that I liked an awful lot. Now, when it comes to the square kilometer array, SETI search antenna, set up a whole bunch of antennas across the square kilometer. Very doable. Making sure they're all aimed at the same location and that you're phasing together the signals from all of them. A little bit difficult, but doable. And if I was now doing it with TVRO-like antennas, television receive-only terminals, which 20 years ago there was a zillion of these antennas, 10, 12, 14 feet in diameter, to do satellite reception in people's backyards. And they were being mass-produced at some very nice prices. To set up a square kilometer of those, I can see it. When you now get to a size of a parabolic dish, 15 meters in diameter, 45, 46 feet in diameter, you're now getting a pretty big dish, lots of hardware, very fancy pedestal, all kinds of fancy motors and gears, trains to move it in azimuth elevation. Now it's getting expensive. In fact, when Frank Drake wrote that equation, the famous equation that allows you to make a prediction as to how often you're going to find extraterrestrial intelligence. Frank Drake equation. Let me drop. He came up with that right at the time that the National Radio Astronomy Observatory, roughly 1965 or so, had just added an 45 foot diameter dish. At that time, it was one of the biggest parabolic dishes around. So they were adding this 45 foot diameter dish to their hardware. He got them to build the dish a month ahead of time, and he did SETI search during that month, and no, he didn't find anything. So a dish 15 meters in diameter is starting to get pretty expensive, and now you're going to put 3,000 of them in the first square mile. Run that by again. Is the dish 15 meters in diameter and 3,000 of them? So we're talking about lots of megabucks here, Paul. WS2N, this is not a simple endeavor anymore. KTRIW, you got it, Paul.
I remember reading about this years ago. It's got to be like 10 years ago. It was proposed. They needed funding, and it was supposed to be online by now, I guess. And now they're only just starting. Just read it about a week ago, so I think they said 2022 or something like that, they should have the thing up and running. But they got a lot of years of building. Something to look forward to. I mean, they want to use it for other purposes, so, you know, it's not only, they will look, you know, look at their other objects in space, galaxies. But, you know, just like the, you know, the Arecibo telescope, that's how they got involved with that, you know, built for one reason, and then SETI, you know, jumped on board and, you know, piggybacked on it, and they were able to use it, you know, that type of system. So I guess they can justify building it, whether they find extraterrestrial life or not. They're gonna have a different way of doing it, though. They're looking forward to all these different spacecraft, Gaia, and eventually test. You tell them when different planets are lined up in the same star system. We drop it. You know, for instance, like Earth and Mars, we're lined up. We have spacecraft now, right now, talking to each other. You know, you've got spacecraft in orbit around Mars, and transmitting back to a deep space network, and also going the other way. If they're doing that on other planets, and they know when two planets in a different star system are aligned with Earth, and somebody happens to be transmitting, you know, communicating, maybe they'll have, people living already on both planets, and they're having regular communications with each other. If they're in line with one another, you know, maybe those signals will be passing that planet and coming all the way to Earth. So, they're going to refine their searches to some degree, and just not look wildly all over everywhere. Back to you, Dick.
To hope you find a pair of habitable planets in the same solar system, and societies on both and talking to each other. From my point of view, Paul, that is a real shot. Good news is that the Kepler telescope found quite a few thousand planet candidates, something like 1,200 confirmed planets, maybe 1,400 confirmed planets, and of all those confirmed exoplanets, something like 5 or 6 of them are somewhat Earth-like, approximately Earth size, approximately in the Goldilocks zone, where liquid water is likely to be on the planets. So 5 or 6 good planets out of, let me pick the number, 12 or 1,300 planets. And notice that in the case of our solar system, let me drop, Earth is very nicely positioned, very nicely sized, got the right amount of water, life formed here rather early, billions of years ago, early life. But you go one planet closer to the sun, Venus, and you got temperatures of 800 degrees Fahrenheit. Forget it. You go one planet further out, Mars, at average temperatures of minus 120 degrees Fahrenheit. You go in a little bit, one planet, way too hot. You go out a little bit, one planet, way too cold. I think you're going to find a solar system with two planets in the Goldilocks zone. I doubt it. So that may not be a reasonable search. That's not even a one in a million chance as I see it. But getting back to these 45-foot, 46-foot diameter parabolic dish antennas, 15 meters each, 3,000 of them per square kilometer. Wow. You and I can estimate how many megabucks that is. I wouldn't be surprised if it comes close to $1 billion, a couple of $1 billion. Yeah, if you get somebody like a Bill Gates financing it, could do that. Would he be willing to put that much of his funds into that kind of a project? Let me drop. And when it comes to the Arecibo 1,000-foot diameter dish, which was really built in order to listen to echoes off the moon, in order to do surveillance, that was the original intent. And because the moon is such a dispersive, lousy reflector, the Arecibo Observatory became an ionospheric research center, became a whole lot of other things. And Joe Taylor went there, and as his doctoral thesis, he was looking at pulsars, and he found a binary pulsar system. In other words, he found a pulsar that's in orbit around another star. And I think Joe was very right to go and look for one of those, because since you realize that the majority of stars out there are binaries, our sun is a unary. They're a little bit rare. Binaries are much more popular in the universe, in the galaxies. So to assume that one of your pulsars is going to be a binary star system, and you can sense the fact that your favorite pulsar is in orbit around another star by the fact that you periodically see positive and negative Doppler shift of the pulsing rate of your pulsar. Your pulsars put out pulses that are so accurate. I used to think that that was little green men, if you know what I mean. That was the signal we were looking for, because they are so accurate as a clock. And therefore, you can see the pulses advancing and retarding as that pulsar star goes toward you and away from you. That's what Joe Taylor discovered when he was at Arecibo. And I believe that was part of his doctoral thesis, and that's what got him the Nobel Prize. And when you go to any of these major microwave conferences, where Joe Taylor is one of the speakers, let me drop it. He will pass around this gold medallion that is the thing that hangs around your neck that is the Nobel Prize that was presented by King in Stockholm. And he passes that around, and we all look at that ooh and ah over it. And for some reason, he wants to make sure he collects it at the end of the lecture. I don't know why. I guess Watson and Crick, Mr. Watson, needed some money, and he sold his Nobel Prize. He's the guy who invented, who discovered the layout of the DNA molecule. And he sold his Nobel Prize, and somebody felt sorry for him and bought it back and handed it back to him. But what was I starting to say? To have a star that's a binary and be a pulsar. Good combination. But to find a star that's got two separate planets that are the right size and both in the Goldilocks zone, I think that may be almost impossible. If they were close enough that they're both in the Goldilocks zone, they're going to interact with each other, and that interaction with each other is going to give you something bad. They're going to hit each other. One's going to be thrown out of the solar system. You can't have two planets that close together. So, who composed that? How serious were they, Paul? I think it's very unlikely. We're down to the last 3 minutes. WS2N with Space Report number 167. K2RA, that's great, Paul.
Yeah, I kind of glanced over that whole story. That time, come I don't know the price for the square kilometer array. I remember reading about it years ago. But now now it's back in the news because they're going to go ahead with it. And whether the European Space Agency is involved in that or not, or whoever, I don't know. We'll find out. And as far as planets talking to one another, you don't think in 1,000 years from now you're going to have a city or multiple cities on Mars and they'll be communicating on a regular basis with Earth? I'm more worried about global warming here. You know, what climate change or somebody pushing the nuclear bomb here. Mars might not have anybody to communicate, but I think 1,000 years from now they'll be talking to one another, and that's what they're hoping for out in the different star systems. We'll see. Running out of time, John 73. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Okay, yeah, Paul. Once again, thank you for the space report. Keep it up. And so, this was TechNet number 1574 of the series that began in September 1982. I think that's 33 years ago. So there's more hours on the air for the TechNet than Johnny Carson was on the air during his 30 years of the Tonight Show. We'll be back next week. We'll settle more of these problems, apparent problems, of RF radiation from cell sites and cell phones and microwave ovens and Wi-Fi routers and whatever, Bluetooth. I can't think of the name of Zigbee. Zigbee, Bluetooth, cell phones. There's around 20 or so wireless products being used today. I think wireless products and radio is going to catch on. Kind to each other. 73, you all. Let me pass it over to John. KC2WGB. Need more information on that 29-centimeter radar experiment. You got it, John. K2RIW.
KC2WGB. Well, good night, Dick. Paul, everyone on the net. I'd like to thank everyone for joining us. And 33 years. So is the entertainer, huh? Ooh. Here's very good. Good stuff. And if all goes well, we'll be back next week. Can't prevent that, I don't think. Have fun and be kind. KC2WGB clear.
at 830 WQVL. Repeater system.
N2PPN, N2ZEP. N2PPN, N2ZEP. N2ZEP, N2PPN. N2PPN, N2ZEP, good morning. Missed you last week. Oh, Monday, obviously, I wasn't on. Thursday and Friday, I was just not in the mood to play radio.
Oh, we don't have to worry around here anymore. They got Howell locked up, so he won't be on the radio for a while.
Yeah, I read the edict. Came through one email.
But you missed his special guest appearances a couple of times, even after the edict was given. It was pretty cool. Guy's totally belligerent.
Oh, I'm glad I missed it then. So when he came on, what happened? They shut the repeater off?
No, announcements were made. And I think subsequent paperwork was filed, so been quiet ever since. But hilarious. Just totally hilarious.
I'm glad I wasn't on, because I didn't need to be a party of that lunacy.
Anyway, so gearing up for Tuesday, Wednesday.
My wife asked, what do I want for dinner Tuesday night? And I told her, because I have specific requirements, something that'll fuel me and not gas me.
Turns out that Tuesday is my wife's birthday, so we're going to go out for birthday dinner before services.
Make sure you get off at an early enough hour.
You don't have to worry about me getting off.
Well, if she works late, then it's her fault. If you work late, it's your fault. You know what happens if it's your fault.
No, no, you got this wrong. If she works late, it's my fault. If I work late, it's my fault.
Oh, you got one of those households. You can't be right no matter what.
What can I say? It is what it is, what it is, what it is. 30 years of you were wrong and I was right.
Yes, know the feeling.
Anyway,
I'm coming up on the 35-year mark.
We're just about to hit 30.
Well, I don't have any regrets over the 35 years.
So, Skeevy. I tried to convince Skeevy to get his bottom wet on Saturday.
When you say the bottom wet, I'm assuming you mean the boat.
Hey, look to your mind out of the gutter.
I said I assume you meant the bubble. I don't know where the gutter is there. That would be the ocean for the sound.
Anyway, went out on the boat on Saturday. It was glorious. Oh, what a day. What a day. It also seemed to be the weekend of older, small, little boats like mine. We saw like three of them, all circa 69, 72, 76. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, Saturday did look like it would have been a nice day out on the water.
If you pick it up some speed, though, it might have been a bit chilly.
Oh, not at all. Saturday was perfect. Temperature was just right. There was just the tiniest little breeze. It was absolutely glorious.
Yeah, unfortunately, the season's starting to come to a close.
Yes, it is. But, nonetheless, with every change of the season brings new opportunities.
So everything else with you is good?
Yes, it is.
Alright. So, let's see, what else? Nothing much. Holidays and everything. I haven't had a quote full work week yet. Next week's going to be interesting. Work week.
Well, nothing wrong with a full work week.
I'm not used to it.
I quit your whine and either work the week or retire, and that's it. Then you don't have to whine anymore about having to work.
There are times I've actually considered it.
Well, that's, you know, getting it to that stage. And it's definitely something to start considering. Oh, I was binge-watching most of the weekend. Binge-watching Lost in Space.
The original series?
Did you know that it originally aired 50 years ago?
I didn't realize it was that old.
38 episodes, and it only ran for 3 years. But it was on Decade TV, which is at channel 112. I saw a little blurb in the newspaper, I think on Saturday morning, about Lost in Space being 50 years old, and it said, oh, it's going to be running on Decade TV. So Saturday afternoon, I found it. I watched a couple of few episodes, you know, when we were in between going boating and this and that. And then yesterday, from about, give or take, lunchtime until bedtime, it was on in one form or another. Got to see the episodes go from black and white to color.
Well, yesterday, my wife had a bridal shower to go to, and this was unusual. They actually had something for the guys to do. Got together at the groom's father's house, had lunch and watched the game together. I'm glad I didn't get to watch the end of the game. I listened to it on radio. I picked the wife up from the shower. It would have been too horrible to watch the end of that game.
Oh well. It is what it is. That's a nice, considerate thing to have something for the husbands to do. Husbands, boyfriends, and whatnot. That's pretty cool. What'd you do, throw down tacks over here in the four-laner?
Not that I was aware of. I haven't had to put my brakes on until right now, the approach to the spiral staircase.
They're getting, like, N2EB and just, like,